Who stole hundreds of thousands of dollars in pension benefits from Iowa's largest public pension plan? This hour, we examine that recently discovered cybercrime. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, a handful of quick conversations to end the week. We meet Iowa's new Teacher of the Year, Eileen Sullivan, as well as one of the longest-serving mayors in the country, Milt Kramer of Manchester, Iowa. Leo Landis of the State Historical Society tells us why he wants us to search for photos of Iowans who served in the First World War. And public broadcasting turns 50. We go back to its birth. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, quick conversations to end the week to some news that we didn't get to otherwise this week. Who stole hundreds of thousands of dollars in pension benefits from the state's largest public pension plan? That's a question. The Iowa Public Employees Retirement System has more than 350,000 members. Perhaps you or a member of your family are in IPERS. And currently, it provides pensions to 115,000 retirees, approximately. Joining us now to help us unravel what we can about this latest cyber crime involving IPERS, Bill Petrosky, senior reporter covering state government for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ben.
So, what was discovered and what came to light?
Well, basically what happened, we still don't know exactly who did it, or they aren't saying exactly who did it, but what happened was that there were a lot of people who are IPERS retirees have online access, but not everybody registers for that online access. And what somebody did, or a group of people did, was that they obtained stolen Social Security numbers and birth dates and used that information to register online to establish account access. Then they changed the direct deposit information and they redirected the people's pension payments to a different financial institution. So what happened was they were looking in their account for these 103 people. Were looking in their accounts and their deposit didn't show up, so they contacted IPERS and their money was missing, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
This was, 103 people losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, at least to the system. The individuals are not going to lose that money, right?
Right. Correct. Mm-hmm. IPERS has reissued benefit payments to the correct financial institutions to ensure that all of the affected retirees will receive their pensions.
Mm-hmm. So 103 accounts here, but discovered fairly quickly, right?
That's right. Well, as I understand it, it happened approximately mid-October, and they found out about it, I believe it was October 31. And most of the people I've talked to, like from the legislature, State Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald, other folks, they've said, hey, we think they got on top of it early and stopped it. This could have been a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Do we know who or what is at fault? Was the system, did it have an obvious sort of hole in it? It sounds like a pretty clever scheme, actually, huh?
That's exactly right. In fact, IPERS had said that they are no longer accepting Social Security numbers for retirees registering for account access. And in addition, the system is monitoring all new online registrations and failed login and attempts. So you're probably going to, there will be some changes. And I think there's a recognition that they need to tighten security.
Mm-hmm. The investigation ongoing. Any hints, any clues as to who this might be in the country, outside the country?
We're not sure. And I, what I've heard is, hey, there have been a number of big breaches nationally, such as this Equifax case, many other cases. I know I have health insurance, and I received something from my health insurance company saying your information may have been subject to a breach. So it's not surprising that criminals may have obtained personal identifying information about thousands of Iowans. And what they can do criminals can do is cross-check that with online sites, in this case, to determine if somebody was a former public employee who might be receiving IPRS pension checks. And so what this shows is that it's important for consumers to create their own online accounts for credit cards, pension benefits, and other financial accounts. And what folks have told me is, look, even if you never log in again after that first time, at least that prevents somebody else from getting onto your account.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mentioned the legislature. What action is this spurring there?
Well, I've been told, in fact, Representative Zach Nunn, who used to be direct cybersecurity for the National Security Council in Washington, D.C., I think he's really one of the people who's going to be taking a major lead on this issue. And I know he is in at Microsoft headquarters actually today with State Representative Chris Hall of Sioux City, and they're talking with Microsoft officials and legislators from other states on a bunch of policy issues, including cybersecurity. And what they've told me is, we're going to be talking with this issue about this issue in the legislature. We're going to be talking with other policymakers. And I also talked with Attorney General Tom Miller's staff, and Miller's folks said they are reviewing Iowa cybersecurity statutes, including identifying shortfalls in current legal requirements for people who store information.
Mm-hmm. Cybercrime, that is a news topic that is not going away anytime soon, is it, Bill?
Absolutely not. And we, of course, all you need to do is talk with folks from the Democratic National Committee. But right here in Iowa, you know, we had a situation here very recently involving the Johnson School District, where some cyber hackers from a group known as Dark Overlord got into why they wanted to get into the Johnson School District system, I don't know, but they did, and they posted information online about Johnson students, and which I think was very concerning to a lot of people. Here in Iowa, we've had other problems here in the past. In fact, I guess this is going back to about 2010, but somebody got into the database for the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission, 80,000 names of people who are licensed by the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. They got onto the website of Iowa Homeland Security and defaced it. There's been other things, too, and you're probably also aware Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate is paying a lot of attention to this. He said there's been no breach of Iowa's election system, but it's something that they're concerned about, and he's going to be talking with the legislature to ask for additional money to bolster their security as well, improve their technology.
Okay. Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register, thanks for your reporting. And Bill, thanks for taking the time to have this conversation.
Always good talking with you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Wednesday of this week at Ames High School, there was a surprise assembly. Governor Kim Reynolds was on hand to name the newest Iowa Teacher of the Year. For 2018, that honor goes to Eileen Sullivan, a chemistry teacher at Ames High School, where she's been since 1996. Iowa Teacher of the Year is an award program established back in 1958, sponsored by the Iowa Department of Education. Its honorees serve as ambassadors to education and act as liaisons to schools, higher education, and other organizations across the state. Eileen Sullivan lives in Ames with her two sons, Lane and Leo, and her husband, fellow Ames High School teacher Joel Sullivan. She was chosen from 80 applicants for this year's award and joins me now. Eileen Sullivan, welcome and congratulations on being the 2018 Iowa Teacher of the Year.
Thank you very much, Ben.
I understand that while it was a surprise to many this week at your high school, you had been told back in September you had to keep it under wraps. Tell me about the moment you found out.
Well, actually, the day before I found out, I got an email saying that they had one more question for me and that we were going to Skype that last question. So then, of course, I spent a very sleepless night thinking, what would that question be? You know, I wanted my first question from interview back. And then we set up the Skype that next day, and it was a Friday at school, and they're always kind of crazy in the fall anyway. And I was literally in shock. I'm not exactly sure that I heard the words of, how would you feel about being the 2018 Teacher of the Year correctly at first. So shock, and then I think as it sunk in, I've gotten more excited as time has come on or gone on.
A lot of press attention this week especially. I understand you took a, back when you were in high school, you took a Career Finder survey in your high school days, and what did it point you toward?
Right. Well, this has always been my kind of joke, is my top two hits on what I should do with my life were chemist and flight attendant. So I think that I've been able to meld chemistry teaching into the combination of chemist and flight attendant over the years and time.
How did you come to choose teaching as a career?
Sure. Way back when I was in third grade, I loved my third grade teacher, and I would draw pictures of me teaching, and I'd pretend teach at home. And then I got to middle school, and I wasn't so sure that I'd want to teach. Mm-hmm. And so I thought science was something I was interested in and seemed to be have an aptitude for. And then I got to my high school science chemistry class in particular, and it was maybe not the best. And about halfway through, I just thought, man, this could be a really great experience, a really fun class, and it just wasn't. So I wanted to be able to do better than that, do better by students. You know, you shouldn't have to sit through that in high school. So I went to UNI and got my degree in chemistry and in chemistry teaching and moved on from there.
Mm-hmm. So you're a Panther.
I am.
Tell us, how do you make it fun in the classroom? Broadly speaking, what is your philosophy?
My philosophy in the classroom is that the students need to do the thinking each and every day, that it can't be me standing at the board telling them and expecting them to spit it back out from their head, which is really an image that a lot of people have from their own experiences in education. It has to be an active learning process where they're being asked questions, they're being given scenarios and situations and opportunities to apply what they know, opportunities to write about things, to talk about things with one another, and to just really show what they know because they're engaged with what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Did I read that you feel a real problem that you've noticed in your years in public education is that students don't know how to take risks?
Right, and it's the passiveness that I think has increased over 20-some years. I mean, there's always been that hesitation to, like, I don't want to be wrong. I mean, I set my room up so that students are able to talk to each other more than having to, you know, be called out in front of the class. But that passiveness of, I'm just going to wait, and she's going to tell me the answer, and then when she asks again, I'll just say that answer back. Mm. And it seems like that bleeds out, and that's a really small risk to take, but increasingly I see students not wanting to do that. So I want to give them an opportunity to have questions that they can answer, that we scaffold them to understand what's going on, and again, give them plenty of opportunities to talk to each other or to talk to me or to write about it. So that they can look at that novel problem, that new thing that comes along, and have more confidence to be able to answer.
Right.
To know what's going on.
Right. Taking risks, though, in the classroom among your peers means you could get it wrong, and that's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. When we look back at you know, our school days. Do you reward people who perhaps take that risk and even in doing so get it wrong?
Sure, absolutely. And I often will ask questions then that could have multiple answers. So even just this week, there was the, you know, hit this or this, and that really how you explain it can make either answer that you choose correct in this scenario, in this situation. So as long as you're explaining what your thinking is, you can work your way out of it. So it's beyond asking yes, no, you know, ABC mm-hmm. questions. It's about open-ended questions that have more possibilities. So then they feel the reward of, yeah, I thought it could be that, and it was.
Mm-hmm. You've been a chemistry teacher at Ames High School for a couple decades. How are we doing encouraging young men and women to pursue science as a career, the STEM careers?
Sure. I think that by making science engaging and interesting and less about regurgitation and it's all about knowing the facts, I think that's what will encourage students to go into STEM careers. We have a lot of access to lab materials and lab activities, so the idea of hands-on and minds-on with doing experiments and things. And then not just leaving it behind, like, oh, I did that lab, great, but bringing that lab throughout, you know, days and weeks and time of talking about what we saw and how we could interpret that. I think that's what will engage students, is making it something more active versus just static information
mm-hmm.
that comes out of their class.
Eileen, I don't know how it was in your high school, but I just wanted to know how times have changed for young women who are have a passion for science and technology, for math. Are we doing better in accepting women in these roles and really encouraging them their passion and not having any sort of nerdy stigma that they run from?
Right. Well, at Ames High, we have a wonderful diversity, and I can speak from our experience here that we certainly have equal, if not more, girls in science classes, maybe even our AP science classes or our foundation science classes as well. And from my observation would be that we are not showing a stigma of girls versus boys within the sciences, that we have an equal opportunity, an equal choice for them to take classes in the sciences and be successful.
Is that different from when you were in high school? Have you noticed? Is that a cultural change?
I was probably different because I didn't ever feel that stigma. I've been asked several times over my career, and I don't know if it's just me. I just never felt like anybody was saying that I couldn't, that I couldn't do the sciences. That didn't come up in my experience.
Eileen, with my youngest still in high school, I know that new technology, smartphones, social media, they offer us new learning opportunities in education, but also new challenges in terms of distraction. Attention span is a concern I know we have with all this new technology and our young people. How do you see young people being changed by all this new communication technology?
Right. I think it goes back to the passiveness, because they can sit in one spot with their technology and they can have the whole world right there. And so I think, again, that leads to this idea that, oh, I'll just wait until somebody tells me, or I'll just wait until, because I didn't have to actively seek anything. I can sit right here. So I think it's that passiveness that comes about from all I have to do is look at my screen and everything I need to know will show up. And then in the classroom, all I need to do is sit here and everything I need to know will show up. So to try and turn that corner and engage students in, I don't want to look at my phone for the next 40 minutes because I'm learning something and my brain is working, and that's a great feeling.
Okay. Eileen Sullivan, 2018 Iowa Teacher of the Year. I'll let you get back to the classroom. Thanks for taking a few minutes of time with us today. Congratulations.
All right,
again.
Thank you so much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quick conversations to end the week. Of course, we had municipal elections earlier this week on our Politics Day. Perhaps you were with us on that day. Heard about some notable election stories this week around the state. One of the notable stories we didn't get to on Wednesday, the re-election of Milt Kramer as mayor of the eastern Iowa town of Manchester. He was first elected when bell-bottom pants were all the rage back in 1974. He's been elected 14 times. He's in his 43rd or 44th year and is one of the longest-serving mayors in the country. Mayor Milt Kramer joins me now. Welcome and congratulations on your re-election.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be talking to you.
How did you become mayor that first time around, your first run for office?
Well, I first was elected to the Manchester City Council in 1969, so I took office in 1970. And I was mayor pro tem, and as fate would have it, in 1971, the mayor passed away. So the rest of the council selected me to finish out his term, which I did do. And then I was reelected to start another term in 72. And I stayed on the council because I was also head boys basketball coach here at Manchester. And I was served from 72 to 74. And as fate would have it, in 74, the mayor passed away. And I finished out his term, and I've been here ever since.
All right. You've been elected 14 times. What is the key to having a community like Manchester support you as mayor again and again over the course of more than 40 years?
Well, I think in the long haul, you know, being fair with people and being able to sit down and visit with them and talk with them. And I spend a lot of time out in the community, particularly now since I've been retired. I've been retired from teaching for 20 years, so I go to a lot of civic groups, a lot of different activities, and I visit the schools on a regular basis. And the kids in school get to know me, and more than likely I had their parents as students when they were in high school, so I know an awful lot of people in Manchester.
I understand that actually some of your former students are mayors in surrounding towns?
In our school district, we have the town of Ryan, Masonville, Dundee, and Greeley. And yes, I had all four of those mayors as students when they were in high school. So I don't know what kind of influence that meant, but you know, I appreciate the fact that these people take the time. I also have a past student on the County Board of Supervisors, and I also have a state senator that I had as a student who is being considered for possibly the Secretary of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm. What other achievements, specifically having to do with the town of Manchester, are you most proud of?
Well, I think basically the development of our industrial park and our expansion in a lot of different ways. We still have things to do. We are short of housing, affordable housing, and we continually to work on that. And we continue to work with businesses and stores. We have a number of different businesses coming into town just within the next couple of weeks.
Now, I see that you've run unopposed 10 times of those 14 times. Is that is that right? First,
I've had opposition 3 times in 14 years.
Okay, so is that because you're this daunting, charming, well-liked figure, or because others perhaps would like just to leave the job to you?
Well, when people see me coming, they know who I am because I'm 6'5", and I weigh about 225. So, size-wise. I tell kids in school that they always elect the biggest guy in town.
So I wanted to ask you about this because you've had a long view of, well, politics at your level, and I'm sure you'd agree, as most listeners would, regardless of what party you belong to, politics and political discourse in this country have become much coarser, much more divisive, combative in recent years. I wonder if you notice any of that at all at a municipal level there in Manchester.
No, not at all. The 5 persons that serve on the city council, I couldn't even tell you what political party several of them belong to. That's what I like about city government. And I tell the Board of Supervisors on the county level, I see no need in keeping party associations even at that level. I see so much disharmony, you know, on the state level and particularly the national level right now in regard to people having these different ideologies.
Okay. You mean you don't send out tweets against your opponents?
No, not at all. Nope. I don't even know how to run a tweeter.
All right. Milt Kramer, nice to talk with you. Congratulations again on your re-election as mayor of Manchester since 1974. Give us a quick word on how long you think you'd like to do this.
Well, I just was elected last week to another 4-year term. So I hope I can still be around in 4 more years, and okay. We'll see what happens then.
All right. Milt Kramer, thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk with Leo Landis of the State Historical Society. He'll tell us why he wants you, Uncle Sam wants you. No, actually, Leo Landis wants you to search for photos of Iowans who've served in the First World War. We'll find out about this program with Leo Landis, the State Historical Society. When we return, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, today, great appreciation going out to our men and women who have served in uniform, our veterans, on this eve of Veterans Day 2017. The State Historical Society is commemorating the 100th anniversary of World War I with a project that asks Iowans to comb through old photos. Joining me now in our Des Moines studio, Leo Landis, State Curator, the State Historical Society of Iowa. Hi, Leo.
Hello, Ben. Excellent to be with you.
Great to have you in our studio. Tell us about this project.
Sure. We are undertaking a project we're calling the World War I Honor Roll, and it actually dates back to 1920 when the Historical Department and State Archives at the time tried to acquire photographs of every Iowan who died in service. There were more than 3,500, and we acquired 2,700 approximately at that time photographs of men and women who died in service. So we're trying to fill out the 900-plus that we do not have.
Mm-hmm. So what is your ask for those listening? Where might these photos be? Where are they typically found?
They could be in family collections still, or if you work for a local historical museum or library with a genealogy or local history collection, or especially there's a good chance that some Legion posts are going to have some of these photos. I know that one of the men who died in service, Glenn Peterson, the post up in Spencer is named for him. So we haven't reached out to them directly, but I bet they have a photo of Glenn Peterson, and we do not.
Mm-hmm. So the number of missing photos is about?
About 900 total. As I said, we have 2,700 approximately that we acquired in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of casualties in the First World War, over 116,000 Americans killed in that first, the Great War, as it was called then. Tell us about some of the pictures. You had a chance to look at some of the pictures you already have. Let's talk about some of these men and a woman, in one case, in the photos that I've seen here, that you already have, a little bit of their stories.
Sure. It reflects some of the diverse aspects of Iowans and how they served and how they died. For example, Rose Buman, who was a nurse, a Red Cross nurse from Shelby County, in the influenza epidemic or pandemic that took place in the summer of 1918 through November of 1918. She was working at Fort Pike in Arkansas and contracted the flu and eventually died then in October. So the Historical Department did make an effort to document the women who died in service too. There are men like Wayne Miner, who was from Appanoose County outside of Centerville. He was a miner physically for his labor. He was sent out on a mission on November 11th, 1918, Armistice Day, the day the war ended. He was killed in action, and so there are so many compelling stories. Black Hawk County, one of the casualties there, was the first All-American football player for the University of Iowa. And young men from Des Moines whose flags we have in our collection in the museums that draped the coffin of a young man from Des Moines, we have those photos. And so we're reaching out to acquire the photos that we do not have.
Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the big names, perhaps the biggest name that we remember from Iowa, Merle Hay.
Right. And Merle Hay from Glidden, of course, Carroll County, rural Glidden. He was one of the first three casualties. We're just past the centennial of his sacrifice and being killed in action on November 3rd, 1917. And so that's something. There's an Iowa Centennial World War I committee that gets together and promotes activities. Some of us were up there for that event on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. So this is just a wonderful way, if someone, one of your ancestors, served our country in World War I, to get in touch. You might have a photo, and if you already have a photo of the person, that's probably not a problem. You'll say that. Maybe it's a different photo, or how does that work?
Exactly right. And we would welcome any photos of women and men who served. The Honor Roll Project will debut then, or it will conclude with a display in the museum outside of our Iowa in the Great War exhibit, where we'll display all the photos that we have. They'll be digitally reproduced in a print format then. And so we can accept both print photos or digital examples through our website. And then we'll have those reprinted and displayed at the museum beginning on Memorial Day 2018.
The photos that I've seen and the examples that you've named, they were all portraits. Are there any other types of photos besides portraits, battlefield, perhaps even photos from trenches? Photography is in its infancy here, isn't it?
We do have a few of those. I think the Wayne Miner photo from Appanoose County. He's in his uniform in that one. It's done in a studio, but he's in his uniform. And so we do have some men on the battlefield. We do have some nurses who served, who lived through the war, and their collections are both in Iowa City and some in Des Moines that show their experience as well. So we're the state museum, and we welcome, in the State Historical Society, we welcome photographs from all over the state.
Leo, when you look at these photos, what does your trained eye as a state curator examining this period in U.S. history, what do you look for? What are some signs? I mean, the clothing tells you it's World War I, but what else has sort of could have catches your attention in some of these photos?
A lot of it will be the hairstyle, too, if it's a woman. Hair length was still a little longer, not quite to the bob haircut or the look of the 1940s when it's World War II. So looking at haircuts is one way on women and to a degree men. Also, the type of fatigues, as you referenced, Ben, the clothing is the giveaway. And so that kind of doughboy helmet and apparel is what works best. If it's a town shot and there are, photographs of men or women at picnics that we have in the collection that are part of our photographic collection, looking at the style of automobiles that might be in the background, too, can be a big help.
Mm-hmm. For those of us not that familiar with the First World War, remind us, what makes it stand out? What set it apart from the wars before and after?
It was the first international war that the United States joined. We came in 1917, of course, in April, and it was an effort, as President Wilson framed it, to make the world safe for democracy. So it was one of those first efforts for us to kind of spread our political and ideals of a republic and share that across the world and help defeat the Kaiser was really the mantra for the people in the United States and in France and England as well. And then the war was really one of those where it's the first time that you have machine guns, you have tanks, you have airplanes, the poison gas, the scale of the warfare. It's always horrific, but this became a new level of horror. And because the peace did not come to a conclusion that was a just peace, I think most historians would argue it's what then set up the rise of Hitler in World War II. So those are some of the lessons and the importance of international cooperation before war takes place.
One of the Iowans you mentioned who died in the war, Fred Becker, a Blackhawk County resident, a Distinguished Service Cross, he received that too. I see here in the notes that he helped destroy a machine gun nest, and that's how he died and also why he was given the Distinguished Service Cross.
Exactly right. And Becker was the one that we had referenced who had been the University of Iowa football player, and so many men were called out to give that level of sacrifice. There are a number of Distinguished Service Cross winners from Iowa, but Becker's story is certainly among the more compelling.
I wonder if this aspect of the war is any way going to be in the exhibit here. The fact that we were at war with Germany, but of course Probably then, as through most of the 20th century, the largest ethnic group in the U.S. and certainly here in the Midwest were ethnic Germans, settlers here. We have an interesting aspect in that, if you had the name Schaefer with a C, S-C-H-A-F-E-R, this might have been a time in history when your family decided to Anglify it and drop the C.
There certainly was. We've got a collection in the museum holdings from a dairy just south of Ames, and they changed their name actually in the 30s, but my suspicion is that part of that was to make it sound less German. And so we have letters even after the war in the state archives collections of citizens writing to Governor Harding, who had issued the proclamation banning speaking any foreign languages in May of 1918, saying in 1920, did you repeal that proclamation, which he had done after the war? But there are still people speaking German in my community, and it's an offense to true Americans, is how the writer phrased it, and, and to the servicemen. So there certainly was anti-German prejudice even after the war.
Mm-hmm. Leo Landis, before we let you go, how do people with photos get in touch?
The easiest way for us is for, and hopefully for your listeners, is to go to our website, iowaculture.gov, and one of the banner promotions will be the World War I Honor Roll. If you click on that, it'll give you the directions to download a submission form, and you can fill out the form and then email it to us at iowaculture.gov. There's also the list of casualties by last name, and also then so that's the entire list, and you also can search by county, and then it's alphabetized.
Okay, what a way to honor a family member in the World War I Honor Roll. Leo Landis, State Curator at the State Historical Society of Iowa. Sounds like a wonderful program that you have going here. I hope you get lots of feedback. Fill in the 900 or so missing photos that you're looking for. Leo, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thank you so much, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finally today, we celebrate a birthday, the birth of public broadcasting. In this country, 50 years ago, on November 7th, 1967, then-President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. It represented the culmination of a decades-long effort to establish a foundation for a media system dedicated to public and community interests.
Yes, the student in a small college tapping the resources of the greatest university in the hemisphere. The country doctor getting help from a distant laboratory or a teaching hospital. A scholar in Atlanta might draw instantly on a library in New York. A famous teacher could reach with ideas and inspirations into some far-off classroom, so that no child need be neglected. Eventually, I think this electronic knowledge bank could be as valuable as the Federal Reserve Bank. And such a system could involve other nations. It could involve them in a partnership to share knowledge and to thus enrich all mankind. A wild and visionary idea? Not at all. Yesterday's strangest dreams are today's headlines, and change is getting swifter every moment.
Then President Lyndon Johnson, 1967, signing the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, 50 years ago. Joining me now, a man who's written a wonderful online article recalling the birth of public broadcasting, also does a lot of archive work in the area of public radio. He works at WILL in Illinois, a 30-year public radio veteran, Jack Brighton. Welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. Glad to be here.
Hey, take us back 50-some years, maybe prior to that, to the forces that led to this Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. Why was public broadcasting called into being?
There was a lot of excitement about radio, which came into existence around 1920. And initially, people didn't really know what it was for. What do we do with this new way to communicate across distance instantly with a mass audience? And a lot of educational organizations got into the picture. Universities, high schools, public institutions like libraries, even businesses like car dealers set up their own radio stations. And they wanted to explore how they could communicate, whether it's an educational kind of service or a commercial service, using radio. And some of the most innovative work done in this period was by universities, because they had, electrical engineers, they had the resources to try some new things, and that kind of became a movement, which then coalesced in various forms. The National Association of Educational Broadcasters was an important component of that. And long story short, this led to a push for support for that mission, to use broadcasting to serve the ends of education and public service.
Not just to sell, soap and shampoo, more than that, right?
Right, exactly. And of course, there was lots of commercial broadcasting as well, and that's fine. But the educators felt that they were getting squeezed out. They had been assigned like lower end of the spectrum. They got the short end of the spectrum stick. And so they wanted to argue for actual resources recognition and the prioritization of education and public service in broadcasting. Mm-hmm. That led to a couple of important commissions, the Ford Commission report, the Carnegie Commission issued a very very well-done report that led to the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967.
Mm-hmm. So funding, I understand, then as now, was a real challenge for public broadcasting right from the start. Tell us about that.
Well, initially, the Carnegie Commission suggested that there should be a trust fund set up that would fund off the interest of the trust fund a national network of local stations and national program producers. Congress didn't go for that. So what ended up happening was kind of a compromise where Congress allocated money every year on like a three-year cycle forward funding for this national system that set up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And stations would have to essentially fend for themselves with a little bit of assistance from the federal government. So that's why we have this hybrid system today where it's really a partnership between some federal funding, sort of seed money, I guess you call it, and then importantly, local audiences and the work of institutions such as the universities at Iowa State, at the University of Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, mm-hmm. throughout the nation. A lot of partnerships that make this a sort of public-private hybrid.
Right.
And it's been very, very successful on that basis. But, although, you know, we wish we had the resources of like the BBC or Japan or even Canada.
Right. Exactly. That's where I wanted to go. The comparison there, the straightforward funding of public broadcasting, Western European countries, Canada, Germany, where I used to live for a long time. Mm. You actually put a small tax on radios and TVs in your house. This funds, of course, a robust public broadcasting system that, doesn't need to go hat in hand anywhere. like the BBC. talk about, we have just two or three minutes left. Jack, so quickly survey the intervening 50 years, the major ups and downs, the changes that have occurred. As we heard in LBJ's statement there, it was envisioned as an educational tool, and we did certainly for a long time have people standing at podiums lecturing, right?
Yes, there was a lot of very boring material broadcast and a lot of very innovative material. It was a big mix, a big experiment to see what could be done to serve communities and people and educational purposes with radio. And of course, television came along in the 50s and became obviously very important. But there are a couple of really important currents throughout this history. One is politics. It's always been a tension between the commercial broadcasting system and the public broadcasting system, not between the systems themselves, but between the advocates for the commercial system who essentially, I guess I would say, have successfully tilted the playing field in favor of the commercial system. And that's why that has become dominant in the American broadcasting world. At the same time, you have what emerged from this public broadcasting app, which was called public broadcasting. And it has continued to do what no one else in the commercial world would do, which was to truly serve the public interest, which was the definition of what the airwaves was supposed to be about in the first place. And but doing that in a number of ways, whether it's local news, in-depth features, documentaries, a variety of programs that people obviously love and need because the audience has consistently embraced and valued the service from public television and public radio. And now we call it public media because, of course, we're online. So the growth of the audience is the thing that stands out most over those 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, the NPR audience has grown by 4 million just in the past year alone. It's really obvious that people still yearn for credible, quality, comprehensive, in-depth news and public affairs programming. And that's what NPR and stations, Iowa, in Illinois and Wisconsin, right, those public stations, that's what they do every day.
And would you agree that, in a way, one never wishes to have funding cuts from the government, but in a way it's turned out we are looking at commercial media enterprises, commercial news media enterprises who are having trouble finding a business model. In the meantime, public broadcasting has made it clear to its viewers and listeners that quality programming needs investment from the viewers and listeners.
Absolutely. And there's the irony, because as journalism and news organizations in the commercial world collapse all around us, because there apparently is no business model for that in an advertising-driven world dominated by internet media, they're looking at public broadcasting as the actual viable model for journalism. And yeah, it depends on, obviously, the community and the people who listen to it and support it throughout, you know, every time you hear us make a pledge drive or, you know, ask for support, people respond, you know, and that's so important going forward.
Okay. Jack, before people think we're going to go into a pledge drive right here, we're nearing, getting very close to it. No, I mean, anyway, explaining the history of public broadcasting, born 50 years ago this week, Jack Brighton, public radio archivist, at also working at WILL in Illinois. Thanks for the knowledge and the look back at the birth of public broadcasting, Jack.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's look forward to Monday. New technology dramatically changing how we communicate and interact, but in doing so, slowly eroding our core principles. That's according to my guest on Monday, Michael Bougea of Iowa State University. He's got a new book out, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine. And we'll find out what that's about on Monday over the noon hour. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.